Welcome. You're about to be ushered past the velvet rope and into a world of hyper-effective salesmanship that's understood and used only by the world's most notoriously rich and successful marketers. We're taking a journey deep inside the human brain, past the surface clutter, and into the psychological insights to answer the one crucial question: what makes people buy? I'm your host, Kevin Rogers, along with the most ripped off and respected copywriter alive, John Carlton. And this is Psych Insights for Modern Marketers. Have you ever noticed how many direct response marketers are also recovering entertainers? Club comics, magicians, rockers, strippers. Hell, I even know of a ventriloquist making a damn good living online. It makes perfect sense, actually, for a few reasons. First, direct response is a creative business, and being able to win a crowd is a huge advantage. All the way back to Barnum and snake oil salesmen, to boardwalk pitchmen, to mail order mavericks and infomercial standouts like Tony Little and Vince Offer of ShamWow fame, you've got to stand out if you want to go big. Secondly, the work pattern is pretty similar. You wake up whenever you want, perform at your optimum level for a few hours, and then avoid going crazy until it's time to perform again. Finally, writers, marketers, and comics are all twisted in the same way. Someone once asked W.C. Fields what makes a comedian laugh. He said, "If you want to make an audience laugh, you dress up a guy like an old lady and you push him down a flight of stairs. If you want to make a comedian laugh, you have to use a real old lady." Having spent 10 years as a road comic, I can tell you that's pretty damn accurate. The parallels in psychology between writing killer sales copy and slaying an audience with jokes are endless, mostly because copywriters and comics come from the same school, the one where class clowns get to outshine the class president. Whether you're after the sale or the laugh, the same ass-saving strategy used by smart runts on the playground to keep bullies at bay will take you a long way toward closing the deal. The kids with comic blood found safe ground as court jesters, while the kids with salesman's blood kept their lunch money by playing the role of trusted advisor. The approaches may differ slightly in detail, but underneath, it's always about persuasion. So considering the many merging nexus, shouldn't humor mix well with sales copy? We see funny commercials on TV all the time, so wouldn't the same rules apply with direct response advertising? That's the question we'll explore today on Psych Insights for Modern Marketers. John, good to have you again here, buddy.
Yeah, it's great to be here. You know, while you were talking, I was reminded of the apocryphal role of the court jester, which is, often a midget in a funny costume who, you know, does jokes and mimes and stuff. But the main job, as I understood it from, the medieval court, was the jester was the only one who could tell the truth to the king. He would do it in a funny way, and if he did it wrong, he would lose his head. But a lot of people couldn't do that, so he'd couch it in humor, or he'd do it in third party mimicking, you know, having those dolls that attack each other,
like a marionette.
Yes. And, you know, it's like the two heads and they squawk and they do stuff.
Yeah.
And then they bounce off each other. And, you know, that was a lot of that stuff, just like a lot of jokes and a lot of nursery rhymes, are thinly disguised political humor meant to deliver a message. And often the message is, you know, you're off base, or the king has no clothes, or whatever. So, you know, people have a long history with humor. We've started studying it. I know that there was some fairly famous Harvard studies, or certainly Ivy League college studies, on humor, trying to figure out what was funny. You know, what percentage of the population actually had a sense of humor, how you could define that sense of humor.
Right.
And there were some studies that actually discovered that. And I don't have those studies handy, so we have to use this as anecdotal at the time. But there were people that were saying, researchers were saying, you could actually determine the socioeconomic status of people by what they laughed at. And that was based on the idea that fart jokes would get a guffaw every time from a lower socioeconomic class than highfalutin Dada's conceptual humor, you know, with no punchline,
right,
which required some sense of, you know, of worldly experience and education and things like that. And, you know, it certainly makes sense to me that there are levels of humor. My big problem getting into marketing stems from my early training was with reading David Ogilvy's famous line that people don't buy from clowns. Hmm. And I believe that's a direct quote. And what he was referring to was when he was making commercials back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, routinely he would get copywriters coming in there who really didn't want to be copywriters into his agency. They wanted to be playwrights, or they wanted to write novels, or they were just kind of checking off time until their real life started. And they would try to do funny stuff, because if you've ever been around a bunch of writers sitting around unsupervised in a room, it quickly turns to hilarity that an outsider may not find funny. You know, Kevin, you and I go through this all the time in the Algonquin Google group that we host. Mm-hmm. And
I would say we had a bit of it in Vegas a couple weekends ago.
We had a lot of it in Vegas. Those dinners were just, I mean, it was hard to eat when you're laughing so hard. But what happens is that in business, what seems really funny in that room with your writer buddies, and then you try to make it into marketing, you can actually make people laugh. Mm-hmm. But does that get the results you want? In other words, it's kind of like the old thing of speaking on stage. The last thing a great marketer who is speaking on stage wants is a standing ovation. You want dead silence in the room when you're done talking, except for the movement of feet to the back of the room to go buy your stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the, you know, money is applause to the person who's selling. Right. To the person who's not selling, then yes, applause, a standing ovation, that's great. Did a good job, wonderful. But if you're in business, it's a different level of result that you're looking for.
Right.
And so we were discussing, I think it might be time, I kind of went off on a tangent, it might be time to bring up that example you had very recently, which kind of illustrates the fact of even funny guys, and we know a lot of the guys in IM marketing, in internet marketing or information marketing, who are funny,
yeah,
but that doesn't necessarily translate to a good sales thing. Well, what's the deal that you have?
Yeah. So, and you know, I can certainly get the instinct. There's a few famous examples, and we won't name names. But I worked on this is actually going a few years back. One of my first campaigns, and there was a comedic character created. And you know, what's also interesting is trying to gauge the reach of humor. So, you know, if you have a list who's responsive to you and you make a funny video with you put on a wig and you create an outlandish character and you get, you know, 10 comments of people going, "Oh my God, that was hilarious. I just showed it to everyone at the party and they all cracked up." You're thinking, "Oh man, this is hot. Like, this has gone viral." But it's actually just 10 people who all kind of want something from you, if nothing more than to be in your circle, right? And so that's, I think, kind of the case with this, where it became, hey, we're going to make this whole sales campaign and we're going to infuse this funny character into it. And we went as far as to have a different, you know, posing photos of the guy and like call out sort of quips at different, almost working like subheads in on the sales page, right? And it was a lot of work to try to. Here's the thing that also made it crazy was it was a serious subject. It was back when the recession was sort of really in full boil, and it was a product about how to sort of, you know, beat the recession. And it was
just ripe for humor and sarcasm.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, oddly enough, the campaign's a disaster. And so, you know, we had to sort of have the come to Jesus meeting with all parties involved. And again, these are really, really savvy, famous internet marketers. And we all finally said, hey, look, let's maybe just try removing the wacky character out of this and let it be serious. And sure enough, the second we did that, the next round of mailing was a huge improvement. So it just goes to show that, you know, one of the inherent dangers is not having an accurate concept or scope of the reach of your humor. You know, not everybody, you know, to have a really successful marketing campaign, it's got to go beyond just your inner circle, unless you're, you know, unless you've got a 500,000 very responsive people on your list, which I don't know anybody who really has that. They may have lists that size and they may have ultra responsive lists, but it's still the 80-20 rule in effect, right? So
yeah, there's a large confusion about what humor is, what's funny, and this is why I keep coming back to the research that people have done into humor. And just let me riff on that for just a second. The mm-hmm. the things that didn't surprise me, but I was glad to see that came out of the minimal research that has been done in this. But again, it was Ivy League studies, or, you know, somebody getting their PhD at least, you know, and looking into it.
Yeah.
And they found out that a large number of people have no sense of humor at all. Mm. And this is not to say that they're less human than anyone else. It's just they don't think anything is funny. They actually don't get jokes. And what was interesting to me is that a lot of these people still go to comedy clubs, or they laugh very heartily at work or at parties when somebody tells a joke or somebody does something. But they're watching for social cues. So there's a number of people out there who will have a great laugh and they laugh at stuff, but they're just a beat behind everyone else. So they're waiting for it, and it's part of the social bonding model that they're going through. So they don't really, if you ask them, what was so funny about that joke? Or you could actually trick them. You could tell something that's not funny and have somebody else laugh, and they would laugh. Yeah. And then you ask them and they can't break it down. And you know, that's a cruel way to expose them. But they are, you know, they regard humor as just another social part of the social grease, you know, so that we don't kill each other and, you know, take each other's food. So knowing that a huge part of the population, and I've heard different, or I've read different numbers, anywhere from under 20% to over 50%, and I guess it depends on the population, just has no sense of humor at all. And just anecdotally, I have, over the years, had a number of people come up to me and ask me to help them develop a sense of humor. And, I have no idea how to do that. I mean, I grew up in a family that regarded humor as one of the social tools that was necessary to survive in a family like mine. And I've always laughed. We've always thought things were funny. And my best friends have always been able to make me, you know, spit Coke, you know, or Pepsi, excuse me, through my nose, you know, as I'm drinking, you know, with a belly laugh. I use Pepsi instead of Coke because people are going to misinterpret that.
Do not laugh into the Coke. Let me tell you that. That's a party taboo right there.
That's true. But, you know, in advertising, you know, people think that, you know, Halbert and I were funny, you know, and we were funny. We tried to get people to laugh, but not in our ads. I mean, people will laugh, but if you read the most outrageous ads that I've written or Halbert's written or Kennedy's written or anybody's written, they're not funny. They're outrageous. So don't confuse outrageousness with humor. We're not telling jokes. What we're doing is challenging the status quo of the reader's mind. We're trying to get him out of that passive reading state or listening state into an active state, which is what they have to be in to be able to punch the buy button or pull out their credit card, and, you know.
But that's exactly what humor does, though, right? So, I mean, you can see where people might get confused, but it really is the same sort of magic trick.
Yes. However, you know, people, you know, the old thing is that, you know, any direct response marketer, anybody who's out there online, offline, in print, using video sales, or anybody that that decides they're going to use advertising as part of their marketing strategy, which, of course, is, you know, only an idiot would not do that. If you're looking to Madison Avenue, if you're looking to the commercials you see on TV for ideas of how to advertise, you're just a stark raving fool, because most of those ads do not do the job they claim to do, because they're not direct response.
Right.
But the ones that are direct response, and I'm thinking specifically of the Jack in the Box commercials right now that are out there, which for years, and this jumps agencies. They've used several different agencies, but the guys within Jack in the Box who are controlling the agency advertising output are sticking with that Jack in the Box figure. A lot of funny stuff goes on. Mm-hmm. I love them. I think they're hilarious. I also like Flo with Progressive Insurance. But what people forget is that the majority of that ad is about the product they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with Jack in the Box, they'll sandwich funny scenes that are well staged, well acted, very expensive scenes around a sales thing. You know, the munchie meals that he's got now, or the special deal on cheeseburgers or whatever it is. So it's very much a direct response. Go get it now. It's out there right now. It's a buck menu. Whatever it is that they're using as the hardcore, non-humorous side of the marketing angle is then sandwiched between some what is pretty edgy humor. They're going after a stoner crowd there right. with their late night munchie stuff, which is, I find hilarious. I have no idea if it's working, but they have gone through focus groups. They've looked at it. They're watching the numbers. They wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't working. However, that's one company in a very crowded niche looking for niches within the niche. In other words, not just people who are hungry late at night, but people who want to feel hip about it. You know, so they're going after a college crowd. They're going after the people who are going to go late at night.
Right.
And they're only running those commercials late at night or during sports things. So they're very carefully targeting it. And for every example like that, there's going to be examples like the Burger King's King, which was conceptual Dadaist, not even funny. It was this creepy king who would wake up. You'd wake up and he'd be in bed with you and then try to give you a hamburger. And I got it because I love that conceptual humor stuff. But as far as selling, it failed spectacularly. I mean, they stuck with it for a long time.
Yeah.
But it did not affect the bottom line. And in fact, negatively it impacted it.
Mm-hmm.
Because people, for whatever reason, we're turning off to that, and yet they love the Jack in the Box character because he's humanized. There's some heavy duty psychology going on there in those Jack in the Box commercials. Also with the flow and the Geico gecko lizard. You know, it's funny, but it's not funny in a way that detracts from the sales message, which has been very carefully crafted. If you think, and your example of helping out your clients there, your clients thought, we've got a good product, we have a good sales message, now let's add some humor.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just do that. You can't just throw humor into something and expect it to work.
Right.
Kevin, you and I were talking about, I know a lot of the gurus in the online world.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of them, and I won't name names, but a few of them really do have an outrageous persona. It's very funny. They're almost – they brush right up against being really offensive to some people.
Mm-hmm.
But they know that there's a huge niche out there that craves this kind of edginess, that likes it, that enjoys it, that takes pride in being part of the tribe that, you know, that this guy has as his followers. And I think that's great. I think he's identified a certain part of the market. It's not going to be everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not everybody's cup of tea, and I offend a lot of people just with the mild outrageousness that I have. I just speak my mind. And when people meet me, they go, wow, you're just like you write. You know, yes, I am. You know,
right.
And, you know, and some people will get mad. They'll say, you know, how dare you, you know, But people get mad at me for misusing grammar, and you know they can't even, you know, and by the time they get read down far enough to when I'm using fucking a sentence, you know, they're gone anyway. So I don't need to worry about those people anymore. But for years I did, and I came out of an old school world where not offending any part of your market was high on the list of a marketer's to-do list.
Right.
And with the advent of the web, which multiplied the number of people you can reach with any given message, that rule has been relaxed. The world has changed. Mm-hmm. The world doesn't often change in the way people would like to pretend that it does. It's very slow to change.
Yeah.
But in this instance, because of the vast reach of the web, you can afford to ignore or write off large numbers of people in your audience because you can replace them.
Right.
In the old days, when you had to rely on lists and it was very hard to get a list going, you had to go through print advertising or commercials. It was very expensive.
Right.
That was a different, you didn't want to let anybody go. So you really played a vanilla line.
Right.
So, you know, it is kind of still the Wild West online. And I think what we're trying to do is just warn people away from what may seem like an easy hit, an easy way to – in fact, that's the best way to think of it. Hits do not equal sales. You can have a video go viral and have people laugh and talk about it. It can make Good Morning America.
Yeah.
It can be talked about on podcasts, and you won't make a single sale off.
Right.
And, you know, to what end has that great number of hits – gotten you, especially if you can't really make a list out of it, you can't hit them again.
Right.
And, you know, for anybody paying attention, especially on the YouTube viral phenomenons, the efforts to do that again by somebody who's done it, are very rarely repeated.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, whole industry of, you know, trying to break down the formula to make something go viral, and it's nearly impossible to manufacture.
Right.
You know, a lot of great points in there. You talk about, well, you know, I want to go back to one thing you said about sort of deciding who you want in your world and on your list, right? That's probably an important thing for freelancers and, all marketers to consider. It's basically comes down to swagger, right? And you have to decide who you want to be. Do you want to be inflammatory? Do you want to be polarizing? You know, how does it make you feel to sort of get into battles once in a while? Does that keep you interested? Does that get your juices flowing? Or does it just make you at the end of the day go, you know, that was a waste of energy. I'm pissed off that that's even in my head when I'm sitting here trying to play with my kids. I don't want to be affected by what some douchebag said in my blog comments or something, right? You know, different people can handle the situation. You know, I'm thinking of certain copywriters who are very, very polarizing with their religious, their political points of view on different subjects, and good for them. I always sort of respect that. I say, you know, here's a guy, but clearly they're turning off a sect of the market. So
it is like attacking your list with a meat cleaver. It's just like the old bar rule in, you know, good bars, good dive bars that have a strict rule: no religion, no politics.
Right.
And good bartenders will usher you out of the bar if you want to start talking politics or talk religion. You will still find that many bars, but those aren't good bars, and there will be fisticuffs and all kinds of stuff, and that's not why people go there.
Yeah, well, so it's a good point, because why would they kick them out? Because they're going to screw up sales. And at the end of the day,
it's
the same thing. Because people, when they get in a political argument, they don't want to drink more. They want to drink more when a good song comes on the jukebox and everybody sings along to it, right?
That's right.
So, you know, what's going to end in a political debate is half the people are going to walk out pissed. And so it's probably the same result. Yeah, you're polarizing. Yeah, the people who dig you really dig you. But will it make them spend money with you? Because that's not why they're in your world, to hear you tell them how to make more money. They're there because they also agree that, you know, teachers should be armed or whatever the hell. So good point there. You can decide who you want in your world, but, you know, be calculated about how you do it. And if you have to have an outlet for your political belief, you know, create a nom de plume and, you know, create a different blog or do whatever and find another outlet for that. And that's not saying, you know, you and I are the last guys in the world to accommodate or cater. But we also have a business sense that dictates how far we take certain things with certain people.
And it's all results oriented thinking. it can start to affect your life, actually, decisions you make with your kids, what school they're going to go to. I mean, how do you even begin to think about what house you want to buy, what car you want to buy, how you're going to do your monthly budget, whether you're going to start a relationship with somebody, whether you want to get involved in something? You have to think farther down the line. It's not immediate gratification that's going to help you make a good decision. And it's the same in marketing. What are you really after? Are you after agitation? You know, do you want to get people riled up? A good marketer may want to get people riled up, but only as a passing stage to get them to that active point where they will be receptive to buying what you're selling. Mm. It sounds cold-blooded, yeah. And in a way it is. I mean, we are literally mercenaries when we write ads, when we use our writing skills not to write the next great American novel, but to write an ad that is going to help persuade somebody. It's people get very, very confused about this. You know, get back to another point you were making, Kevin, you know, I have trouble trying to get people to stop talking in kind of a passive like a passive voice when they're writing ads or writing marketing material about something that's going to change somebody's life. We're talking about people who have health problems, people who, you know, have financial problems, people who are desperate. And these people have, you know, adopt this tone of, but, you know, before I tell you this, let me tell you a story. You know, I was born in a log cabin, you know, back in, you know, in the old days. And it's like, no, you know, when you understand your prospect is in an urgent state, you want to mimic that state. And whatever the conversation you would have face to face with them is the way you want to have your ad run. So if you're trying to use humor in an ad about, you know, curing some illness or solving some financial problem, right, or, you know, a lot of the things that people have, even if it's, you know, I have a business that's going under online because I can't get people to click on the buy now button. And then, you know, if I'm in that situation, tanking business, I'm using precious time to look at your ad, whatever the heck it is you got, and you go off on tangents, you know, explaining, you know, back when the web started, you know, let me tell you a little bit about, you know, what I was doing back in Silicon Valley in the early 80s. No, that's, you know, you try to match the sense of urgency that your market has. Sometimes humor can play into that, but it has to be carefully crafted and it has to be there because it meets a need. Right. And sometimes, if you'll notice, when people are like let's take the bar situation. Somebody starts talking politics in a bar. The bartender comes over. He has a couple of different ways to do it. A bad way to do it would be grab him by the scruff of the neck, pull him over the bar, hit him with the bar bat, and then throw him out the door. The other way would be go over and in a very low, sotto voice, you know, tell him, if you continue talking like this, I'm going to call you over the bar and hit you with the bar bat, et cetera. The other way to do it, the third way to do it, is to use humor. Come over and say, look, you know, you're a funny guy. Last guy in here that talked politics, you know, see that moose up there? We're having his head taxidermied. We're going to hang it on the wall over there. So, you know, shut up. You know, and, you know, humor is a social lubricant. So sometimes, even when you're talking about serious stuff, you can use some level of humor, but it has to serve a purpose. Right. Humor in and of itself doesn't sell. That's what David Ogilvy was getting to with the people don't buy from clowns.
Right.
People will buy from a clown, literally the Jack in the Box clown, if what they need to hear involves being cool and the clown is perceived as cool.
Yeah.
You know, if there's already some level of trust or there's some level of social okayness, in other words, you can match this up against the Ronald McDonald, you know, the McDonald's clown. He was never very funny, but he was put in there to lure children. McDonald's always had a family-oriented marketing strategy. It right. was all about pleasing the kids.
Yeah.
Jack in the Box wasn't like that. Jack in the Box got their start being a late night, being the only thing that was open in many towns back when I was growing up in the 70s and even in the 80s. If you were hungry late at night, it was Denny's or Jack in the Box. It wasn't a third choice. And they've continued that. They're still making a lot of money money off of the open all night, you know, drive through things. So think about that. You can't just say, well, their commercials are funny, so I'll use humor. You know, what does humor work in there? And, you know, I think in an email exchange you and I had, yeah, I was talking about the different kinds of humor. And it just off the top of my head, I was listing there's wit, there's clever wit, there's sarcasm, there's gentle humor, there's edgy humor. There's conceptual humor, there's physical humor, there's satire, there's puns, and then there's joke telling. So, you know, I've actually seen people get up on stage in front of some audiences and tell a joke, and it's because there was a model of doing stage presentations where you wanted to make people laugh. That was part of the bonding process to get people on your side. However, that looks old and kind of creepy now, because it's in the internet age, it's very rare to find a good joke that somebody hasn't already seen. Either it's been emailed by Uncle Bob, who, you know, forwards everything he gets,
right,
or it's, you know, there's just not a lot of jokes out there. So, you know, this leaves you with wit. If you're going to be funny and you're witty, sometimes you don't even have to plan it. You can tell the guys who are really, truly witty when they're on stage or when they're writing, because the humor just kind of seeps in there anyway, but in appropriate ways, and it always has a purpose. So I've always tried to make people laugh on stage, and it's like in parties or, you know, hanging out with people, especially with the writers. If anybody starts telling jokes, I get a little pissed off, because jokes are just memorized. You know, it's rote memory,
yeah,
and you rattle off a joke and ha-ha, isn't that funny? But there's no back and forth. There's no, you know, a joke is told by one person to a receptive crowd.
Right.
Wit, on the other hand, true wit is exchange. It's back and forth. It's one-upmanship. It's kind of like improv theater, where they have the yes and rule.
Yep.
I've written about that quite a lot. David Deutsch was getting involved in some improv a few years back, and we use that a lot when we would talk to hot seat audiences.
Yeah.
About how the rule in improv is, if I start an improv segment, I say, oh my God, a UFO just landed in the backyard, you then can't say, no, that's not a UFO, because that kills the thing right there.
Right.
But you could still disagree with me by saying yes and. Yes, and I actually think they're from Washington, D.C., and it's a drone, you know, and you move on from there.
Right.
So that kind of agree, you know, it's moving things along. And knowing what you're doing. So this idea of, you know, wit, sarcasm, gentle humor, edgy humor, conceptual humor, it's good to start to break that down. I don't think a lot of people have done a lot of that, especially marketers thinking about that, especially marketers who aren't necessarily funny guys. They may laugh, they may have a decent sense of humor, but they're not initiating the humor. They appreciate good humor, but they're not necessarily the guys who are initiating it at a gathering or right, anything. So it's dangerous for those people to get involved in humor, because if you're not even sure what will make people laugh when you initiate it, you really can't know what your list is going to laugh at or what they will find. So
yeah,
the job of humor is, you know, I can even see using humor seriously in a health oriented piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I had a challenge or if I thought that would help, and it would come as part of the bonding process, and that would be dependent on me totally having walked in the shoes of the prospect.
Right.
If I was outside of that, I was a man talking to women about some pregnancy thing, I would not, you know, be humorous at all. But right, if I had a cancer scare, gone through it and come out the other side, and I was talking to people who are going through the same thing, I might be able to use humor. You know, I would use a gentle humor. I would not try to make it conceptual. I would not go on and on, but I may do that to give that, because I know from experience that humor is part of that process of being either on the inside or the outside. And being on the inside means you can actually joke about it. And if you're not on the inside, don't joke about it. This is the problem people have with using derogatory words to minorities. You know, they figure if the minorities are using the words with each other, then it's okay for me, you know, Mr. White Guy from the rural farm to use it too. And, you know, that's missing the entire point of what's going on. And it's part of bonding, it's part of tribal behavior, and it's part of a very not it's a very complex role of communication and kind of buzzwords, and they call it dog whistle words and things. You have to be aware of this stuff. If you go into a market and start using slang, let's say you're not a golfer and you write a golf ad, yeah, and you use slang that golfers use, and you're reading from a book or a list of golf slang, and you don't actually know where that came from,
yeah,
you're going to fall on your face. And
right,
that's an innocent way. If you get deeper than that,
yeah,
and you know, you can not only fall on your face, just like you said with marketing, that client you had,
yeah,
you did nothing but take out the attempts at being funny,
right,
and totally transform the nature of the ad.
Yeah,
and it worked.
Yeah, there was no way to soften it. It had to just go. You know, it wasn't like, oh, maybe there's just too much humor. It wasn't like, hey, if we left two or three, yeah, of those blurbs in, it'd be okay. It was, you know, and so it's a great point. It's an all or nothing proposition. You know, I've been the only white act on a all black bill in an all black club.
Uh-huh.
And it was a thrill for me to be invited into that situation. It was a Bernie Mac show at a jazz club in Chicago.
Wow. And
yeah. One of my favorite stories. Let me tell you, it was funny was the show was so great. I actually kind of forgot I was part of it. I was so caught up in the show. The talent, it was a variety show. The talent was so unbelievable that when Bernie walked by and nodded to me that I was next, my first thought was, oh, man, I hope I don't fuck up the show for my own sake. Like, you know, I'm enjoying it so much, I'd hate for the next act to suck, you know?
Right.
Especially since it's me. But the point is, I would have never thought in a million years to try to go up and use the N-word or, mm-hmm, you know, like that would be bonding. So it's so far beyond me when people don't get that. But, you know, you see it a lot in young people today. You know, young white dudes who aren't actually around black dudes, but listen to rap music all day and night. They'll call,
what was that song? Pretty Fly for a White Boy. Back
for a white guy, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the thing. Suburban white kids trying to act gangsta. And, you know, they'll call each other, two white dudes walking around the mall calling each other N-word and this and that,
yeah,
right? And, and if they had any idea... And, you know, so, people, a reporter, I
have to say, I have a friend whose son came home with a friend from, I think it was junior high. And the friend comes in and goes, yo, bitch, what's up to the guy's mother?
And, wow.
And, you know, she was not just taken aback. She turned him around, marched him outside, you know. And the kid was just, what did I say? You,
yeah,
know, it's like, wow.
Women are bitches. What? Yeah.
Yeah.
Bitches and hoes. Well, that's just, you know, a reporter famously asked Chris Rock, when is it appropriate for a white comic to use the N-word? And never.
Yeah.
Never. What, you know, what part of that don't you get? So, anyway.
Well, it's a big part. It's a constant problem. And you know, I have just to tie into that, you know, I have dealt with a lot of people with no sense of humor who actually are offended by people trying to be humorous. I mean, everything is serious to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel sorry for them, but there are a number of people like that who will tolerate humor, and they just know, oh, he's being funny, I'll wait until we get back to the actual, you know, to the actual deep stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, however, the trick is, and this is where I've, you know, kind of measured myself, I don't want them to turn off. I don't want them to think, oh, this is a funny part, I better skip this or whatever. I want that funny part to be so ingrained in the sales message, mm-hmm, that they can't skip it. So,
mm-hmm,
they're still doing it. They may resent me for forcing them to read something that would be funny to a normal human being, but they're going to tolerate it. So that kind of ensures that your customer base is going to be a little more tolerant.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I guess that's getting kind of off on a tangent. But you're going to any market that you have, any market size, any list that you put together is going to have people in there who are either not going to get the joke, they're going to feel maybe alienated by you even trying it. So you have to keep them in mind, but you don't take any power away from the bonding that you're doing with people who do get it. You have to decide,
yeah,
if how important it is to be funny as well as outrageous. You know, a lot of my ads that I've written over my career are just drop dead serious. They're straight on, you know, here's what we got, you know, here's how to get it. It's, you know, it's just selling. There's no humor. There's no outrageousness. There's a lot of ads didn't even have hooks because there weren't any hooks. And yeah. A hook wasn't necessary for bringing that market to that particular that product to that particular part of the market. Right. So you just keep adapting as you go. But I think the main warning is that if you're not funny or, you know, have a reality check on just how much your sense of humor is part of your sales message. Mm-hmm. And if it's not organic, if it's not coming from your heart and moving out into the world, if you're hiring somebody to go be funny for you, that's a big no-no. If you are, you know, if your normal conversation is either, you know, swearing like a sailor or being outrageous or funny, then, you know, go with it, dude. You know, that's it's going to be easier for you to bond with your crowd doing that. I like the term organic humor.
Right. Well, exactly. And organic humor is, you know what it is, based in truth, right? Like harsh reality, truth. You know, I think of a guy like J-Mo, right? You know, he's often very funny when he posts online. Uh-huh. He's always so transparent and so on. I've sat and watched videos of him crying to the camera, and I'm thinking, why the hell am I watching this? This, you know, but I he's a friend and I care about him. But it's like, why would you post your breakdown? I don't. He for him, it's some sort of therapy. But I think he really cares and wants to help other people who may be feeling the same way. But
I've known J-Mo for a long time, and you are absolutely dead on. He has a disarming element to his personality that allows him to go places other people can't go or shouldn't go. And I think he has a very clear-headed understanding of that, but he still, even if he tried, he couldn't manipulate that. He couldn't fake it. He couldn't say, and, you know, write down a note, oh yeah, minute five in this VSL, I'm going to, you know, be emotionally vulnerable. No, it's just, you can't do that. That's his game. So he's bringing it to it. It's honest and it is transparent.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. That's really the only way I could see to get away with humor. Look, humor is the ultimate Teflon. You know, you cannot let's think about Jack Black, right? Say Jack Black got caught in some scandal that didn't hurt other people. You know, say he made a bad investment and TMZ said, you know, he lost $2 million. Well, a lot of people would be embarrassed and avoid that conversation. He'd be the first guy to come on with Matt Lauer and go, yeah, let me tell you this crazy story.
Yeah.
You cannot mess with Jack Black. You cannot mess with guys who are so funny and so transparent and aren't afraid to be the target of their own humor. It's the ultimate Teflon. It's when you take yourself too seriously that you're an easy target. Donald Trump is such an easy target because no one takes themselves more seriously than him. And so, you know, anybody delusional enough to run for president when they're a reality TV star, you know, it's just ridiculous. So,
you know, that's a really good point. And just to touch on politics, one of the most viciously effective tools that politicians have is mockery. Mm-hmm, if they can find a way to get a meme that goes viral, mm-hmm, mocking their opponent or their opponent's strategies or legislation, that gets picked up by the media. That becomes the catchphrases, things like that. So that kind of selling an idea in an inherently hostile environment, which the political, you know, world is, it's, you know, it's me against you, it's A against B. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff can work. You know, sarcasm has no place in advertising though. A troll-like behavior, people confuse winning through intimidation, humiliation, or mockery. You know, you can shut down. You can walk into the best cocktail party in the world and where people are laughing, having a great time, and one little conversation niche by the next, you know, shut the whole thing down just by going in and being negative and mocking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's my thing against first world problems. The first time somebody posted on a Facebook thing I had, you know, I was complaining about something, you know, I was being funny.
Yeah.
And somebody posted, yeah, first world problems, which is a meme going around, which is we should not – We should just keep quiet about anything that we think is bothering us because people are starving in you know, the sub-Sahara.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I went after the guys. You bastard. You know how dare you shut down this thread? If, you know, unless you're out there building sanitation huts, you know, in the backwoods of Kenya,
yeah.
You know, then don't do that. You know, it's a troll-like thing to do. And, you know, it maybe got a laugh once 4 years ago, that right. whole meme of first world problems, because it is a it's a time for self-reflection. It's like, wow, you know, you can't go off on that. But it's been done. So now it's nothing more than a shutdown piece of sarcasm.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you start that's why I'd like to break down everything. And breaking down humor, there's not a sense of humor. Anyone's sense of humor can be broken down into multiple parts. And the guy who thinks fart jokes are just the funniest thing ever is, you know, and doesn't get, David Letterman's, you know, Dadaist, you know, bits. Mm-hmm. which come from, you know, which come via Ernie Kovacs and a long history of, you know, Monty Python, you know. You know, it's almost like you can make somebody, you know, if you could make your list sit down and watch an early Monty Python skit.
Yeah.
And, you know, half would laugh, half would stand up and leave the room going, what was that all about? And, you know, you don't want to do that to your list.
Right.
So the conceptual humor, the hard edge stuff, the stuff that's damaging, the stuff that may be funny to your pals, but isn't funny to somebody who doesn't know you and isn't sure if they're the butt of the joke or not, you know, stay away from that stuff.
Yeah. And again, I think it comes down to being able to have a sense of humor about yourself. If you don't have a sense of humor about yourself, about your product, you know, establish that within yourself, within your company, and just say, we shall never entertain. We shall never feign being entertained. Right. And just make that a rule because, you know, look at the example of there was the great thing, Facebook thing. I think it was in the UK. A guy posted a really funny status update about body form. I guess they're feminine hygiene products. Did you see the post? It was cute. It was all about how, you know, they lied to him, and growing up seeing their ads, he thought that women had this time of the month where they were joyous. They were out cycling and skydiving and he thought he was jealous. He thought, oh, it must be the greatest thing in the world, this one time a month. And so he finally got a girlfriend and couldn't wait for this time of month to happen. He thought they'd go kayaking and it turns out it's a terrible time of month. And she turned into a demon, and how could they have lied to him? And they ruined his life. And so it was very funny, and it went viral. It's had like 100,000 likes in 5,000 comments or something. And just within that thread, by the way, you can see the range of people who get it and don't get it, and people who are taking it too seriously, and other people.
Yeah.
So what Bodyform did was they made a hilarious video in response to it. They seized an opportunity to climb into the jet stream that this guy created and show that they had a sense of humor. I mean, it's a really funny response. Hilarious. Huh. The woman, you got to, you know, Google body form response, and you'll see probably the thread and the video response. Really well done.
That's a great little piece of homework for anyone listening to go check that out.
Yeah, it's just to wrap up the point about having the ability to not take yourself seriously and get the joke and then actually one up the joke is like the best defense in life, you know?
Yes. But, you know, be sure that you're doing it. You know, be sure you test it out in the real world before running it out to your list. I was just going to add, I have a colleague, an old friend who is wheelchair bound and interested in the anti-aging stuff, science coming out, in that he believes that stem cell research will eventually lead to him walking again. Mm-hmm. So sounds like a very serious project. When he and I talk on the phone, we laugh a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy's got an excellent sense of humor. Mm-hmm. We don't laugh specifically about, you know, certain things, but, you know, a lot of things are funny to him. And, you know, so I would not hesitate to translate that sense of humor when he's talking to other people in similar situations. It's like, but again, you got to be careful. You have to understand what the context is for what's funny and what's not funny. So, I'm going to check out that body form thing. Did you, you know, the Lululemon yoga pants? Have you been following that thing?
No.
They came out with some yoga pants. You know what Lululemon is, right?
Right.
It's a very exclusive women's wear shop. Well, actually, they do have clothes for men, but they tuck them away in the back. It's mostly primarily a female market. And they came out with these yoga pants, which they pushed very heavily and hadn't tested enough. And it turns out they, on women slightly, let's say, larger than the models they had, you know, made the pants for, the pants become sheer, you know, see-through. And they also don't fit very well. And the owner of the company, the man and his wife, were on TV, and he said, a lot of women just shouldn't be wearing yoga pants. Something like that. There's a picture that I've seen of the wife shooting him the drop dead look while he's saying it on TV. Their stock tanked.
Oh, man. Wow.
Huge blowback. He's now out apologizing as much as he can. But that was an example of being disconnected. You know, he wasn't trying to be funny. He was trying to be what he felt was truthful and transparent and saying, well, there's just a lot of women out there that shouldn't be wearing this stuff. You know, you're not built right. So essentially don't darken our door. And you know, obviously he's not in charge of the marketing. It's probably his wife that's the genius behind the company.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of lesson runs true all the way down the line. You know, pre-test this stuff.
Yeah.
The wonderful, wonderful world of the web allows you to test in small numbers.
That's right.
Look at, you know, and do incremental buildups.
Yeah.
Rather than just say, what the heck, I'll just mail this to my entire list and see what happens.
That's not a
great marketing tactic.
That's a fantastic point. You know, in Perry Marshall's new book, he talks about that and how you can cheaply test things, especially with Facebook ads and things like book titles. People test now through those ways and simply just see, you know, which one resonates by which it garners the most clicks. It's pretty.
That's how Tim Ferriss came up with 4-Hour Work Week. He it came from him asking people on blogs what a good title would be. So
yeah, right. So, and clearly you went through a painstaking process with your latest book.
No, actually, everybody told me not to use that.
I chuckle every single time I see your book. Every single time.
We're talking, of course, about The Entrepreneur's Guide to Getting Your Shit Together. I've sworn that, you know, not to do that. And I get more people coming back saying, what a great title. Oh, they're leaving it on their coffee table just to irritate relatives when they come by.
I love it.
But again, that was calculated. Yeah. It wasn't market tested, but it was calculated. And I, of course, am not going after massive sales. I could care less about the New York Times bestseller list. I just wanted to get the book out. I'm having more fun being a self-publisher.
Yeah.
Had I gone with any of the multiple programs out there trying to get on the New York Times bestseller list, things like that, would have totally
spent much more time on the title trying to, and probably not come anywhere near that particular, you know, the one that I actually used. So.
Right. Yeah. It's similar to your first book you wrote. It sounds like we're plugging your books. Not what we're doing, but I think it goes back to the conversation about, look, be transparent, but in a calculated way. You know, your book titles immediately say you're in or you're out. This resonates with you, or it annoys you so much that you have to look. And when you look, you'll discover. Well, that's what I call the Howard Stern effect, right? All these people that swear, they listen because they hate him, and they can't believe, they need to know what he'll say next because he's poisoning our society. Bullshit. You're laughing somewhere deep inside your dark little soul as hard as anyone else, and that's why you keep going back. So, but, you know.
Wait. Well, hold on to that thought. Because you just touched on a key mem in all of these podcasts we've been doing, which is the lack of self-awareness most people have. This is not a fault of the human being, listening to this. If you don't totally understand yourself or your sense of humor or what you respond to or why you're doing anything you're doing or why you're not doing anything you're doing, it's not your fault. Self-awareness is not part of the default equipment we're given when we're launched into this world. It's like a muscle you have to develop from almost from scratch. So being aware of what you're laughing at, why you're laughing at it, why you bought something, having these constant reality checks going, that's the main reason I've been interested in these podcasts myself and what we're talking about. When we talk about the psychological nature of human behavior, it's not just so that we can laugh at our neighbors and stuff. Most of this comes from self-evaluation, running ourselves through rigorous bullshit detectors, and keep going to that. JMO, I love him to death, but I'm not sure he's totally aware of everything he does. He's on a constant search. It may take him a while, but he's headed in that direction. Not to pick on JMO, myself is even a good example. I had all these psychological tools at my disposal during my career, and I was using them in ads, but I wasn't always applying them to myself. It was a long, drawn out process. If I can help anybody shortcut that long, drawn out process that I took, half a lifetime, to become even a little bit self-actualized, understand even a little bit of why, how I tick and why I do the things I do. And I still encounter things every day that I'm not sure why I did that or why I said that or why I'm doing that. And you're talking about the titles of my books. I hadn't really thought about it, tell you the truth. I tested the title on a few of my writer friends. They all told me I was crazy. And I had a very brief, meeting with myself and said, screw them. And, Michelle thought it was the best title too. And that just kind of sealed it. It was like, yeah, I got one yay, 14 nays, and to hell with it, I'm going with it. So, but there's a lesson to be learned in all of this, and it's not something you naturally do.
Yeah, that's right. That's an excellent point. The people shouldn't count themselves out or feel excluded, but you can get
because you're funny, feel like you got it nailed.
Yeah, good point. Good point. A lot of people are known as the jokester and secretly are annoying the hell out of most people around them and really think they're funny. So, again, it comes back down to becoming self-actualized.
You know what supports this point is who's the guy who's doing Ram Trucks now, the comedian?
Yeah, right. I was going to bring that up. It's Will
Dennis
Ferrell. Dennis Leary. Okay.
Oh yeah, the Will Ferrell ones,
the Anchorman. Is a whole thing.
But Dennis Leary does his jokes, not a joke to be found. I think it's Dodge Ram. He is reading copy written by a professional about Dodge Tough, and it's just Dennis Leary's voice. It's not what he would do as a comedian.
Right. Good point. Yeah, paid spokesperson. Period. Just read it and go home. Best money.
The Will Ferrell stuff is the conceptual humor that proves the rule. In other words, it's the exception that proves the rule. Will Ferrell has decades of goodwill built up for his market, a couple of huge successful movies and a reputation. He's kind of like Bill Murray is a good example too.
Yeah.
Bill Murray walks into a room, you're going to start chuckling just seeing him.
Yeah,
you know, right. When he plays in a golf tournament, they just watch him tee off and people laugh.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
And yet he's done totally serious roles, and it's like he's been able to do both of those. But you know, he understands where his humor comes from and when it's appropriate and when it's not.
Absolutely. And you know, had an interesting thread about that Anchorman 2, the truck series. And, you know, some people would say, well, I don't
love them.
Yeah, I love them, too. And here's my point about why I think they're effective. Because, look, Dodge decided to stand out and say, look, everybody else is showing the trucks in slow motion driving through mud, and it's okay, you can tow the space shuttle with it. everybody's constantly trying to one-up each other on how muscular their truck is, and to the point where it's become ignorable. Here we are ignoring our truck to bring you an inside joke. You can all, like, you know, the kids and the old people in the room probably have no idea why those ads are funny. They're also not
the target market.
That's so. Right, and so a lot of them are. My kids think they're hilarious because we told them they're hilarious, and then they started seeing them through the eyes of I bet these are funny, and now they anticipate them, and they go back. Oh, rewind that. There's a, you know, and so it's become a couple. But they never saw Anchorman, the original. They don't know who Ron Burgundy is. They just know that this guy looks funny. And the old people don't get it on purpose so that the young people can kind of glance across the room at each other like, haha, we're in the club. So what the brilliant message is there from Dodge is them saying, look, we're so confident in how kick-ass our truck is, we don't need to show it hauling the space shuttle. We'll actually take a back seat to bring you something really hip and cool. And now you go look in. If you're going to go shopping for trucks, you're going to do the research anyway. What moron doesn't go online and compare Dodge to Ford to Chevy when they're buying a truck, right? If they don't have an affinity either way, you're going to do that research.
Yeah, you just touched on something interesting, which is the idea of being cool. You know, if there's anything more misunderstood than the value of humor, especially in marketing, it's the coolness factor. What's cool, what's not. I mean, I'm outraged that the word cool has been co-opted by fashionistas, you know, who, you know, either you look cool, you know, you know, so-and-so looks really cool the way they dress. No, you don't look cool. Cool is an attitude. But, you know, I lost that battle, you know, decades ago. But the sense of cool for the people in the know understand that. A lot of humor is being used as a dog whistle for coolness.
Right.
And that's why it's like, I would never think of having a Dodge Ram truck, but if I got a Dodge Ram truck and I had it, I might put up a bumper sticker or something of, you know, Ron Burgundy.
Yeah.
And that would be an instant coolness factor. Like people getting, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember those commercials. I mean, it's just there's a whole other layer. I mean, it's, I hope they tested it out and I hope it's working because I think it's great for, you know, commercials to be able to incorporate this stuff sometimes.
Right.
As they break free of the standard ways of trying to sell trucks and stuff.
Right. And, you know, there's sort of a layer beyond that. You talked about Dennis Leary simply reading his, they bought his voice and his attitude, right? No humor whatsoever. Don't even show the guy. Now, the opposite is true with these Dodge ads. They hired Funny or Die to make the ads. It's not even their studio. It's not Mad Av writers. It's Funny or Die going, how funny can you make a truck ad?
Of course, they're not direct response ads, though.
No.
You know, the problem with looking at, you know, car ads is that the car ad is much like the soft drink ads. The real, you know, the soft drink battle is won on shelf position in major stores in 7-Elevens. The truck battle is won on the sales grounds of the, you know, the Dodge dealer versus the Chevy dealer across the street. So there's, you know, a lot of it comes down to money, a lot of it. So there's all these other layers of buyer behavior. What was that company, car company that came out where you couldn't haggle over the price? The Saturn?
Well, CarMax is a big thing where it's used cars, but it's the same idea. It's like,
yeah, but let's just pretend it was Saturn. If I'm wrong, I apologize. Mm-hmm. But the idea was everybody, whenever they did a focus group or whenever they did a questionnaire to people, people were mad about needing to go haggle over buying a new car. They didn't like it. They didn't like to do that. Right. So whoever it was, Oldsmobile, whatever, came up with this company called Saturn. It was an offshoot, a niche of their company, mm-hmm. where there was no haggling. The price, the sticker price was a sticker price.
Yeah.
The concept failed. It turned out that people hate haggling, but they also will not buy a car without haggling.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the you know, it's don't look at what people say they'll do. Look at what people actually do. That's why, you know, salesmen have to be rooted in reality, not in some sense of what they think the world should be like or what they wish it was like.
Yeah. Well,
so it's hard to look at this stuff because it's hard for a truck manufacturer to influence things very much, because at the end of the ad, it's got to go to your local Dodge dealer and see what great deals on Dodge trucks are happening right now. Then it's up to the dealer to have the good salesman to go in there and they have leeway and they're going to make their deal. So a lot of it, you know, it's a very big purchase. So
yeah,
don't, you know, if you're selling a $19 book, try to avoid looking at Madison Avenue, especially television ads that really are either selling branding or are selling something so foreign to what it is that you're selling that there's no connection. Not all marketing is the same. You sell different things with different senses of urgency, with different slightly different tactics, with a slightly different language. There's a lot of things that go in. So it's not a simple, well, they did it, so I should be able to do it.
Right, absolutely.
Just doesn't work that way.
Great point. Yeah, great point. And we could go, but I just want to quickly say, have you noticed the corrective trend in auto ads is they show, the joke is that the husband pretends to be haggling while the family stands outside the glass doors. And it looks like they're haggling, but the guy basically made a deal with the salesman. Wow, that's a great price. Look like we're haggling. And they actually argue over sports or something, right? And the family's like, wow, he really went in there and did it. Good, you know. And so, but maybe that is a perfect illustration of your point is that, yeah, people do want that exchange. They want to look like a hero to their family. Yeah, I got the best price. They want to brag to their neighbors.
Yeah.
If you went and bought a Saturn, go, oh, well, you didn't get a deal. Yeah, I didn't get ripped off. Yeah, but you also didn't get a deal.
Yep. Yeah.
So great, great illustration of that point. All right. Well, this has been a fantastic hour. We could go on and on. But I want to say, you know, the big takeaways are – if you're going to be decide if you are funny, want to be funny, want to be regarded as funny, and then test it small, set parameters. Always let any copy cool overnight. Let funny copy cool probably for 7 nights.
Yeah.
Show it to a lot of friends, get feedback. And if you really want to become, you know, wear a coat of Teflon, be transparent, but it takes a lot. It takes a certain kind of person to be ultimately transparent and be able to laugh at yourself. So if you're not that, don't pretend to be that. If you are that, find ways to embrace it and make it a superpower.
You know, and just to add to that, Dave, what's his name from Wendy's?
Thomas, yeah.
Dave Thomas was one of the most boring,
right.
You know, he was everybody's grandpa, and he made that work. So he was transparent, honest, not funny. So, you know, kind of the opposite of what we're talking about with some other examples. So it doesn't matter. It's more the transparency and the honesty than it is the any kind of personality value that you might think would work better.
That's it. Great point. Okay, John, excellent show. Love it all.
Yeah.
And everybody, please come see us at PI4MM.com. Leave your feedback. Tell us what you think is funny in advertising. We'd love to hear stories of times you've tried it or seen it tried where it bombed. That's always more entertaining than the ones that work. But we'd love to hear about what you think are good examples of humor in any advertising. So we'll see you.
And be sure to tip your waitress.
Please, on the way out. Yes, and drive safely. And please don't take any of our matches with you if you are drinking and driving. We don't want the cops finding those and come and ask us questions. All right, man.
See you soon. Okay, pal. Bye. It was great.